This episode brought to you by Origins, technology for today's lenders. Before we get started, a quick word from our sponsor, Community Financial's present CEO, Tansley Stern's new podcast, Despite Impossible. Now on to the show.
Hey everybody, Mike Lawson here with CU Broadcast. Welcome to our continued coverage of the 2023 CUNA GAC here in Washington, D.C. And in the studio lounge, we have Mr. Robert Eiler from Sonoma State University. You're an economics professor there, obviously. You've been on the show a number of times, so people know who you are. But you're also a board member at Redwood Credit Union, which brings you to the GAC this year. So welcome, sir. Good
Thank
to see you.
In person. Yep. Yeah, not like this, right?
Yeah. Usually we're doing our Zoom calls for sure, but I'm glad to see you here. This is a nice surprise.
Thank you.
Yeah. So what do you hope to gain by coming here to the GAC in person, Rob?
I mean, the three things we normally come for, like I think about coming here, is to see if there's anything I need to know from a credit union standpoint as a board member.
Yeah.
So just thinking from a director's level, what do I need to do? And thinking more about our own leadership as board members and what we do as board governance. Mm-hmm. The second thing is to try to get any other insights on the economy. So more of as an economist, I kind of think about, is there any little thing I'm missing that I might hear, you know, like from CUNA's economics group. So I'm going to go to the thing later today on that. And then the third thing is just trying to meet people and trying to see different ways of thinking about credit unions. So, you know, there's larger ones in Redwood. There's a lot of smaller ones.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of, you know, little lessons both at the sort of governance level and at the member level that you don't hear about unless you talk to people. And so this is one way of getting everybody together.
Gotcha. So do you know Mike Schenck at CUNA? So
I met Mike a few times.
Okay, yeah, because he's obviously the economics guy there at CUNA. So I'm figuring you guys might know each other or cross paths every now and then.
Yeah, we do.
So share with me some of the latest things going on in the economy, because we've all seen like news reports that, hey, you know what, maybe the recession isn't going to be as severe as it possibly is. You want to share with us your thoughts on that?
Yeah, totally. So one of the things that's been intriguing, and it's been very intriguing since the pandemic, to watch how economists have kind of waffled a little bit on looking very, very far forward. So usually our window is about 2.5 or 3 years absolute maximum. Now that window's gotten a lot smaller.
Oh, yeah.
So what's been intriguing is over the last 6 months specifically, there was a lot of talk about potential recession in 2023. Then when the inflation number started to go down a little faster than a lot of economists thought it would, there was the belief that at least the Federal Reserve would take their foot off the gas in terms of raising rates, and that would sort of weave through 2023 and maybe early 2024 without tipping us into recession. But the thing that's funny about recession is that it's declared by a body called the National Bureau of Economic Research. It's not an actual phenomenon that takes place. It's an analysis that takes place, and then a declaration of,
really?
We think this is when it started and this is when it ended.
I had no idea.
Teach it though, but this is the thing, is that we teach it as if you have two negative quarters of GDP growth after inflation,
Classically
you say, okay, well, if real growth has dropped in two quarters in a row, you're in recession. Well, that's actually technical recession in the sense that starts the gears turning toward.
Haven't we done that already though?
We did it. So the last two quarters of 2022, we were negative.
Okay.
So a lot of people started talking about it, but but if you looked at all the sort of tea leaves that are used to declare recession in the United States, they weren't all there, and hence we didn't have one declared. We kind of entered it, but when we exited it in quarter three.
Okay.
So and there's a lot of weirdness around that. So the point is that over the last 6 months, the original idea that, okay, we're going to finally get to the point where all those pieces are going to come together and we'll have declared recession. It looks like we might just narrowly avoid that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So the forecast had picked up. So in fourth quarter, the forecast was basically for somewhere between 0.5 and 1% growth in 2023, entire year. Now it's picked up to between 1% and 1.5%, which suggests that if the negative quarters were there dragging us down in the original forecast, they may have now faded away a little bit, hence no recession yet.
Okay.
But it's going to be slow.
Oh, my
God. So what I try to tell people is going to be this, like, it's going to be kind of a quagmire year where not a lot happens, but you don't really descend any further.
Well,
but we have to weave through this year.
That's good, though. I mean, I think that's good news, you know, based on what we were talking about just a few months ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, oh, my gosh, the sky is going to fall, you know. Now it's like, okay, pump the brakes a little bit here.
Absolutely correct. Yeah, so those are kind of the new-ish things. The one thing that is kind of funny, though, is on Friday, the data came out on inflation that the Federal Reserve tends to use when they look at rates. It's called core PCE, or personal consumption expenditures price index inflation, and actually crept up a little bit.
Oh, it did.
Last month. And that's usually seasonally adjusted, and so it has all the other pieces out of it that you kind of want to see successive months down, mm-hmm. down, down. Mm-hmm. It's trended down, mm-hmm. but this sort of hopscotching around trend is where the Federal Reserve might get a little nervous about actually stopping the process.
Yeah. Are they going to continue raising rates? I heard they're going to do it maybe two more times.
Yeah. Maybe? The betting money is that we're going to see about another 75 basis points by the end of the line in terms of where the Federal Reserve thinks it's done its work. They're kind of signaling
okay,
that.
Okay, I got you. Yeah, yeah.
And so right now, especially like I said before, if the inflation rate has crept up a little bit and we're worried about it actually creeping up a little further, because mm-hmm, mm-hmm. the other thing about avoiding recession is that can actually spur on more business and consumer confidence, and then you have people spending more
exactly.
again.
Exactly.
Right.
There
so the inflation relief allows you to go back in, and yep. then it kind of teeters now without much change. So that'll make the Federal Reserve a little bit more concerned that the job's not done yet.
Yeah, what a science, all this. I mean, we've said it a million times.
Right.
There's so much science behind this type of stuff. The other thing I want to talk about was jobs. We're in such an interesting time with the labor market because, obviously, as you well know, unemployment is at record lows.
Yeah.
Or at least it was, but it's still pretty darn low. But at the same time, there's all these fintech layoffs, these other layoffs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so what is your take on the labor market right now? And even yet, talent is still hard to find out there as well. So
oh, yeah.
It's just such a weird time.
It is. And what's also been bizarre is that, you know, we teach economics and macroeconomics specifically saying that when rates go up at this speed, you have to assume job losses are coming.
Yeah.
Because businesses are going to slow down.
Yeah.
They know
yeah.
consumers are going to slow down.
Yeah.
So why am I going to produce anymore? So I'm going to really think about reorganizing my labor portfolio
mm-hmm.
and start letting people go.
Mm-hmm.
And we started to see that in tech, kind of not immediately, but we knew that shoe was going to drop and it started
yeah.
to.
Yeah.
What's been intriguing is that not only has the unemployment rate not picked up, and even if you look at across the array of unemployment measures we use, it hasn't really changed that much. And that starts to lead you to believe that there's either a bunch of people who are working that we weren't counting that were contributing to GDP, but not necessarily counting the labor force,
mm-hmm.
which might be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The other part is whether or not people have actually left the labor force and have no intention, even with higher wages, to come back in.
Okay.
And that could be because we finally had a wave of retirements that are now permanent.
Yeah.
And the jobs they left behind
yeah.
are not necessarily being rehired, either because
really?
They're too expensive. So what you'll get is you'll get this weird effect where unemployment's not necessarily changing that much.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can't find the workers, and the workers that would be in would be unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of have this weird understatement of the unemployment problem because people have exited the labor force and they've stayed out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that third cell of people are the people that left for some reason when the pandemic happened. They've been assisted through the additional bumps in unemployment insurance and other government payments that
mm-hmm.
we've seen over the last couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and now that's all fading.
Yep, yep.
So those folks might start creeping back in.
I think so, yeah.
But it's not necessarily going to surge unemployment, and the job openings levels are still relatively high and under the belief that businesses are still looking for workers,
mm-hmm.
which is just kind of, and that's what makes it so bizarre, because you think that we're tipping close to recession, interest rates have shot up like this. You know, where is that sort of balance point at which we should expect the tip, especially because unemployment and inflation tend to be inversely related to each other.
Oh my goodness.
So there's a lot of wackiness that
you
can't weave out. And most of the forecasts, though, if you look, Mike, there's not that many forecasts out there that are suggesting we're going to have sharp job losses. Even with slower growth, even
yeah,
with higher inflation,
yeah.
even
yep.
with higher rates,
yep.
there's not the surge, and the belief is that we may actually have a shortage of workers that is structural rather than cyclical.
Too. Yeah, yeah.
And I shouldn't really kind of mix metaphors like that, because if somebody's an economist and watches this, they'll think that's not right the way to say about structural unemployment. But the idea about structure is that you actually have people who are now making a permanent decision not to re-enter, even with wages higher,
mm-hmm.
because they're retiring,
mm-hmm.
or they have
mm-hmm.
cash that is giving mm-hmm. them the choice about what they
yep.
do.
Yep.
The other little quirk, and I'll stop on this one,
no,
is that...
Okay.
We don't count the self-employed when we talk about unemployment. So the actual labor data you hear,
yeah,
and the self-employed have usually been a very small amount of the overall production level in the economy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That has changed, but we still have not made, as economists, we have not made a real-time adjustment to that number.
Interesting.
Yeah, so we don't know how many people have retired,
yeah.
hung a shingle,
yeah.
are producing something
yeah.
parallel to their retirement,
yeah.
and perhaps actually choking off the opportunities for other businesses because they're basically stripping demand
mm-hmm.
based on the networks they had built and then moving that demand to themselves versus their old employer. So there's a lot of those nuances that we don't follow as economists very well at all in real time. I mean, in fact, if we figure that out, it's like 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you bring that, because we've seen a lot of retirements in the credit union industry, a lot of executives that turn over and, you know, new blood coming in. But I've seen a lot of these, you know, credit union CEOs who have retired, but they start their own thing. They start their own gig. They start their own company, or they go to work for somebody else type of thing. So they're not like they're retiring from their position at the credit union, but they're going and starting either their own consulting firm or they're joining a firm or something like that. So I totally get your trend that you're talking about here. And one more thing I want to talk to you about was just housing, because we're about to enter a new housing year, and spring is right around the corner, and we all know that's the beginning of house buying season. Yep. So what are you seeing out there as far as housing? Because right now that seems to be a bit of a roller coaster as well. Well,
absolutely. So one of the things also that has been very tricky as economists, when rates go up like this and you hear about job loss, the first thing you're thinking is, okay, this is going to now start the tumble down the hill in housing prices.
Yeah.
And it has slipped downhill, but not necessarily rolled quickly. So
It went up a lot.
It went up a lot, right? So,
so
and this is
back.
Like a typical situation.
Right.
So if you look at California, over the last 2 years, California housing prices at the median, the middle of the distribution, have increased about, let's say, 32%.
That's amazing.
It is. Not historic, but pretty close.
Yeah.
So you say, okay, so it's going up 32%. You just like every other asset market, you have to expect prices are going to come back a little bit, right?
Sure.
So we knew this was going to happen. But in almost every other asset market, and if you look at the equity market, we went basically up to the top of the hill and right back down, and we gave back 15 months worth of gains, basically over about 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd expect, okay, well, if housing markets work like equity markets, because they're both ownership of asset markets, we should see some comeback.
Yeah.
And we just have not quite seen it with force. And how much of that is a lack of supply? How much of it is that people have already made a move and hence they're not as mobile as they have been in other times? So for example, if I left San Jose and I went to Franklin, Tennessee, or I went to Austin, Texas, or I went to Charlotte, North Carolina, unless my employer is telling me I have to come back, we might have a slower amount of demand, and I might actually lose my job, but it doesn't mean I'm going to put my house up and move again.
Right.
We just did this.
Right.
So
right.
It could be there was so much mobility between 2020 and 2021 that there's a disincentive to be mobile again. Hence, the existing unit supply does not go up with force.
Yeah.
And if you haven't built enough new housing against demand, the supply is not there to bring prices down against demand slipping as much as you think. So if they have slipped, which suggests that demand is slipping and supply is catching up a little bit, but if that gap exists, there's still some support for housing prices at their current levels, partially. So there was originally a lot of, I would say, you know, pessimistic forecasts that were out there for about 6-8 months around housing, 10-15% downturn maybe in 2023 nationally in kind of state of California, which had a little bit more exposure maybe to housing prices changing. That's all kind of like ground down now, somewhere in single digits for 2023.
Yeah.
The other idea is it might extend a little bit. So instead of being a really quick, abrupt change in prices, it might now expand over a couple of years.
Yeah.
But we have to expect some give back. All the conditions that were there to raise prices in 2020 and 2021 have now basically reversed.
So
the economics of it's pretty straightforward.
Crazy what was going on.
And you knew you had to come back. The key is, though, is that it's supply and demand at the end of the day. So, and as complex as we want to think housing markets are, and of course it's a complex personal decision when you do it, it really boils down to what's the demand and how many houses are available. And if people aren't putting their houses up for sale quickly, and you're not building fast against demand, prices aren't going to change that.
Yeah, I know houses in our neighborhood that have gone, they're selling much slower than they did. But they're selling, they're still selling. People are still, they're still turning over, but it's just, it's a much slower process. Because before, people put their house, boom, it was gone.
Well, and the other thing that I've heard, and this is something that's also kind of bugging me, because I don't know how permanent this is how many people are actually not affected by interest rates changing in terms of their use of cash. So the supposition is maybe they made parallel wealth in the equity market to whatever they were doing otherwise. They're now cashed out of that, and they're looking to put as much cash as they can in their home to where the interest rate changing is not really a marginal decision for them in terms of buying the home. And if you think about it, mortgage rates while up,
it's still pretty low.
It's still historically not that high, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of those factors are kind of making for a confused marketplace in terms of what you think would be happening. But we're still kind of in an experimental phase about having rates so low for so long.
Yeah.
And then what's the reaction of buyers when they start to go up to this now middle ground?
That's exactly what I was thinking, because I think it's kind of a behavior type thing. And I may be way off base here, but a lot of these, especially first-time home buyers, we've seen a decade of these like super low rates, and all of a sudden they spike up to 4 or 5, whatever they are. Who knows what they are right now? You'll know. But anyway, but I think once you get used to that number, and then it creeps down a little bit, then, oh my gosh, we're at 3 again.
Yeah,
you know,
let's go.
Let's pull the trigger, you know, as opposed to maybe 2 years ago, they wouldn't have done that. It's like, oh, let's wait for 2, you know, or wait for 1.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I think it's coupled with all that stuff, I think it's a behavior thing, too, especially with newer home buyers, I think.
And the most emotional decision you make generally when you invest is your home.
Completely.
Right? I mean, even though you might get emotional about stock at some point because you're mad about it, right?
You're
not
going to
get emotional about bonds, but usually you're going to get emotional about your home.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
That's people, your baby. It is a lot more behavioral driven sometimes than it is just pure economics.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. This is so much. I love talking. It's so much fun to talk
cool.
about this
Thank
type
you.
Of stuff. So,
yeah.
I'm eternally fascinated with this stuff. So, yeah, I'm so glad you're here. So
Thank
good
you.
To see you in person. Anything else? Any other items you want to check on before we wrap up?
Well, the only thing I would say is that, you know, I think you're going to see one of the other sort of themes that's running around credit union industry is the loss of deposits. So
the
drain of deposits that's happened.
The war for deposits.
And that's also another search that economists are all fighting each other intellectually about is, you know, what we think the genesis of it is people are now they're slowly draining it against inflation, meaning they're paying more per month.
Yeah, yeah.
And that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It could be that they're also, people have made larger decisions with their money, or they're moving them away from deposits into
mm-hmm.
other vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And we were seeing some of that too, but that's, I think you're going to see the one thing that's going to be the biggest challenge we're going to be talking about, and we'll probably be talking about it at GAC next year too, is what do we do in terms of generating more deposits, and are we able to keep loans going
mm-hmm.
against that market?
Yeah.
How many credit unions actually got themselves ready for that phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
and how many did not?
Yeah. You know what's funny is that I remember being in this exact spot in 2020 doing these interviews, and the same argument or the same statement was saying we need deposits, and all of a sudden that pandemic hits, and all of a sudden we're flooded with deposits.
Right.
You know, oh my gosh, how we've come back to full circle again. So it's really interesting.
And the credit unions that manage that process well, I think, are the ones that will come out of this well, and the ones that didn't are going to be scrambling for deposits.
You got
for sure.
that right for sure. All right, Robert, thank you so much again. Always appreciate
Mike.
Your time
you
and
bet.
Your expertise, and look forward to the next chat.
Thank you.
Well done, sir.
This episode brought to you by Origins, technology for today's lenders. A quick word from our sponsor, Community Financial's present CEO, Tansley Stern's new podcast, Despite Impossible.